Well, welcome to another Academic Agent Retrospective. This is volume 16, and the whole of this volume is concerned with a run-in that I had with Adam Friended and PSA Sitch, ostensibly over a video I made called Zoomers Are Coomers. Now, that video is already part of one of the other retrospectives. I think it's volume 5 on degeneracy, or you could just watch the video, it's still there. And in this video, basically, I was arguing that the whole kind of meme of men imagining themselves as this little worm character licking the abs of a buffed up girl is problematic because it is failing to conform to traditional gender roles, which I am in favour of maintaining. Apparently, Adam and Sitch are not in favour of that. Such was the freakout. But essentially what happened is that I made this video, got a lot of views, 50,000 views or something, and PSA, Sitch and Adam did a 3-hour kind of reaction or response to that video and kind of freaked out. And they were demanding that I went on their channel and debated. Now, if you know anything about me, friends, I don't really do debates. What I did instead was, in the time-honored fashion, I just made a series of carefully edited and researched videos where I kind of responded to them and outlined and elaborated on my argument, essentially. What transpired after that was basically a big falling out between me and these two total clowns. I like to say I've got the best rogues gallery in all of YouTube. You know, obviously, Lord Keynes 2 and Ray Murasami, they're kind of classic, old-fashioned nemeses of mine. I kind of got them quite well with Lord Keynes 2 these days. Ray not so much. Adam Friended back in the early days used to come on my shows, and we were quite friendly because we had a shared love of Jonathan Haidt's Righteous Mind. But unfortunately, Adam is prone to letting his emotional elephant get the better of him. And PSA Sitch is somebody who I didn't really know much about, but any respect I had for these two gentlemen went out the window when basically they refused to watch these videos and instead insisted on trying to stoke and create drama. And then PSA Sitch was like continually going on Twitter, you know, accusing me of this, that, and the other, basically classic kind of shit lib nonsense. They basically show themselves to be like idiots, basically, over this whole debate. Well, anyway, because the only part of it that I actually took part in was these four videos, I've collected them together. So it should be quite interesting to go back and revisit the arguments I made and how they have informed, later thought and discussions that we've had on the channel. All right, I hope you enjoy this one. A few nights ago, Adam Friended and PSA Sitch made an 11-hour stream, over half of which was dedicated to responding to my video, Zoomers Are Coomers. Since the stream was so long, I put together a 1-hour edit for people to be able to see it in a digestible form. I now want to formulate a response to them. Rather than take it point by point, I have distilled the issues that arose down to four broad areas. Number one, on the appeal to authority. Number two, on the liberal need to psychologize. Number three, on self-actualization versus the freedom to be degenerate. And number four, on civilizational collapse. Now, it is possible that in the course of making this series, that other issues may arise and that there will be more than four parts by the end. But let us use this as a starting point. Each video will follow the same format. We will watch a small clip of Adam and Stitch, and then I will respond. First, why is this necessary and worthy of my time and yours? While I do not think that Adam and Stitch cover themselves in glory on their stream, I think this is an opportunity to clarify a number of things. Also consider this my own version of Mencius Mollbug's open letter to progressives, in so much as it is part of my ongoing program to deliberalize your mind, and not just your mind, my own too. For I too was born in the ashes, and I too have been a degenerate of the lowest order. So let us begin.
Yeah, it's okay, we'll skip.
Now, what is the traditional answer to all of this? Let's see what Julius Evola says.
Look, one of these books from 10,000 years ago. Let's pull out this old-timey book. Get the dust off it here. Then how is it any different if Vosh goes to Google and says, you know, I need an argument in favor of worker co-ops. Here, let me see what's on Wikipedia. And academic agents saying, you know, society's falling apart because of these, you know, the decline in traditional gender roles. Here, let me Google all of history to find a quote from some fucking moron so I can, you know, cherry pick history to prove my argument.
Okay, that's not really
what I call cherry picking. How is this an argument? I mean,
it's not. There's no arguments here, Adam.
Some guy a long time ago said this. How cool is that?
It's like, I know.
This is a devastating argument because this dude 50 years ago said it.
From the scripture, he's about to read from the scripture. Okay?
He's not citing data here, Aiden. He's not like he didn't do a study.
I'm well aware, but I'm saying that I do appreciate when people are able to bring in some kind of.
I don't, because I feel like it's an appeal to authority. That's like, who the fuck is this guy?
But I would rather someone bring in some kind of historical relevancy rather than just make shit up on the fly. That's all I'm saying.
I think it adds a false sense of authority to it that it doesn't deserve.
That's the point.
I actually totally agree with you, but that's why they do it.
Where did this guy get this information from? I'm thinking maybe he prayed. God told
him. Okay, I'll tell you where. He took his hand and he reached deep in his gut.
I know.
Okay, he shoved it right up into his gut. And he wiggled around, and then he grabbed something, and he pulled it out, and he smelled it. And, okay, this is what I want.
This, if you replace this picture with a postmodernist, I'm not seeing much difference here, Sitch. I fucking hate this, too. I totally hate this. It's like,
I mean, sure, that's true, but that's a good thing. The liberal waters we've swam in have created the most successful, best society the world has ever produced.
Yeah, but we've been thrown a lot of shit at us that we've said, no, fuck you. We make up our own minds, you fucking idiot. Fuck you. Like this whole idea that this thinking is just you because you've been indoctrinated by culture. Dude, sign up with the SJWs. That's their fucking argument.
Well, that is true.
Yes, I've had... Listen. I'm reading about Austrian economics. I'm reading about MMT. I can make up my own fucking mind, okay? Don't tell me that you only believe liberal things because these are the waters you're swimming in. Get fucked. Get fucked. Seriously. How fucking condescending is that? Get fucked, okay?
Right, but you can't dismiss it. That is the woke SJW Marxist argument, is that the culture is so oppressive, so overwhelming that people are just stuck in it. They can't think for themselves. And it's funny because, as Dev said, the argument whenever you disagree with them is always, well, you need to read more Marx, or you need to read more of insert academic, okay?
Oh, what a fucking insufferable goddamn fucking argument. It's always the argument. Sure, you just haven't read enough.
Right, and that this is sort of not exactly the same argument, but it's kind of in the same ballpark of that argument. Like, oh, you just need to read more non-liberal and liberal in terms of liberalism. You think of some, you need to read some anti-liberalism thinkers, okay? Then you'll understand.
Well, I presented the quotation from Julius Evola. Adam Friend, it seemed, affronted, not because it was Evola per se, but by the very idea that I'd be drawing on a quotation from an old book written 50 years ago, which contained no scientific studies or statistics. He accused me of two fallacies, appealing to authority and cherry-picking. Now, on my course, Foundations of Logic, available at the academic agency, I spent two whole lectures on fallacies. If I were to be tedious, I could spend 2 hours listing all the fallacies that Adam and Stitch committed during their stream, but I do not think that would be helpful to anyone. Now, there is a fallacy known as ad verecundium, or the appeal to reverence. For example, the doctrine of Aristotle is the supreme truth because his intellect was the limit of the human intellect. It is therefore rightly said that he was created and given to us by divine providence so that we might know all that can be known. Why is this a fallacy? Because it is resting entirely on the idea that Aristotle had almost superhuman powers of intellect and that, therefore, everything he said was correct. But this does not mean that there is not a legitimate respect to which an author can be considered an authority from which to draw when making an argument. For example, if I were writing an essay on poetic and dramatic structure, Aristotle codified those forms in his book Poetics, which proved extremely influential for over 2,000 years in Western literature. So quoting Aristotle on the subject of dramatic structure is an appropriate appeal to authority, while saying that he had an almost divine intellect, which could get nothing wrong, is fallacious. Now, it seems to me that many liberals, not just Adam Friended, but my old friend, the Britisher too, struggle with this concept. To the Britisher, for example, practically all thinkers are equally invalid, and any and all quotations from thinkers are appeals to authority. I know this because I did over 100 shows with him, and he voiced this opinion again and again. There is no difference in his mind between the Austrian economist and the Marxist. In fact, Stitch on the stream made a similar point as seeing no distinction between Marxists and an illiberal thinker like Evola, and he saw me drawing on Evola as akin to a Marxist telling them that they need to read more Marx in order to understand where they were coming from. Adam Friended even said that Evola sounded like a postmodernist, as if any and all intellectual arguments exist on an equal and equally invalid footing. Although it should be noted that Friended does seem to accept the difference between advocates of MMT and Austrian economics. Why those books are valid but Evola is not is unclear. But let us get to the point. When I drew on the lengthy quotation from Evola to outline what the traditional view of masculinity and femininity was I guilty of ad verecundium, or was it an appropriate appeal to authority? Well, first, what gives Julius Evola the right to be an authority on this question? Adam Friended asked, what is the difference between me drawing on that quote from Evola and Vaush, for example, typing a search into Google for an answer that he wants? Well, first, and academic agency fans, Foundations of Research is good for this topic, Google is not a reliable source for giving you an authoritative answer. And the results that Vaush would be seeing are at best sorted by the greatest number of citations and at worst either random or sorted by acceptability to the current status quo, which amounts to the same thing as greatest number of citations. Second, Evola was one of the few authors uniquely suited to answer this question because he devoted his life to the study of capital T tradition. He wasn't randomly chosen by me. He was chosen because he wrote over 25 books on tradition, including books on yoga, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Zen, alchemy, and other esoteric topics, as well as over 300 essays and over 1,000 newspaper articles. These are not irrelevant details. Evola is not some random Reddit poster or Twitter user or Wikipedia entry. He is someone who comes packaged with considerable learning and wisdom. Now, he was not neutral. He was associated with perennial traditionalism, which is a school of thought, which believed that there is an absolute truth that stands above and beyond all known cultures, and to which all known cultures had local manifestations. Why is this significant? It's significant because he wasn't writing as a Christian or as a Muslim or as a Buddhist, but as somebody who was attempting to stand outside of his own time to see what was common among all traditions of civilized humanity. That means he spent time studying different doctrines from the East as well as the West. And had Stitch known this, perhaps he would have not have spent the time that he did dwelling on the superficial differences between conceptions of masculinity from one era to the next and from one culture to the next. Evola would have seen the mundane differences that Stitch was pointing out as mostly meaningless because he was reaching for a higher level of definition, an essential masculine and feminine form that transcends time and place. Now, I will leave the specifics of his conception and Adam and Stitch's respective problems with those specifics to a later video. But for here and now, it is important to establish that this conception was not random, was not, as Stitch suggested, simply pulled from his rear end, but came after years of study of multiple doctrines. Evola did not believe in a materialist conception of human nature and would have been confused by Adam Friended crying out for scientific papers on this topic. For him, ancient wisdom had already revealed the truth, and science could add absolutely nothing to what was already known, but confusion, as we have seen in the past few years. My drawing on Evola, as opposed to, let us say, Jordan Peterson or Jonathan Haidt, was significant for epistemological reasons too. He approached knowledge from a metaphysical position wholly beyond modern scientific materialism and in keeping with the teaching of perennial traditionalism. But this was not some mystical or emotionalist mumbo-jumbo, but rather wholly rooted in a traditional ontology. Jocelyn Godwin wrote to René Guénon, who was the spiritual mentor to Evola, the following: "Mystical experience and religious devotion are certainly intrinsic elements of the spiritual path, but as Guénon never tired of emphasizing, the ultimate realization of a human being is through knowledge. Some may find this whole approach too intellectual, but they cannot deny that the traditionalist discipline of metaphysics cuts like a razor through the sloppy thinking and sentimentality prevalent among New Age types. It sets standards of integrity against which other spiritual teachings either stand or fall. It assumes from the outset that the absolute truth has always been there for the finding, so it has no time for the fumblings of Western philosophy, so-called, nor for a science whose basic dogma is that man is still searching for the truth. And it incidentally forces a re-evaluation of all the modern ideals that most North Americans take for granted, such as individualism, equality, evolution, and progress. One looks at the world with new eyes once it is passed through a traditionalist re-education." This perhaps explains why Adam and Stitch found it so difficult to get a handle on the Evola quotation for over an hour, because he's coming from a place wholly outside of their entire framework of knowledge and critiquing it from the outside. The unprepared liberal faced with someone like Evola will struggle because his worldview is simply put alien to their modern materialist mindset. As Goodwin puts it in the same essay, "One's first encounter with perennial traditionalism can be a traumatic experience. Anyone who feels at ease with the intellectual attitudes and scientific theories of our time should think twice before opening its books, for they may find that their worldview suffers a blow from which it will never recover." I'm not suggesting that this is what happened on the stream, but I am suggesting that we witnessed extreme cognitive dissonance and unease, and I have seen many of the viewers in the comments instinctively feel that Evola has awakened something in them. So, it did matter that it was Evola. It was a non-random selection chosen to buttress my own argument. Adam Friended seems to believe that it would have been better not to do this, to articulate what he was saying in my own words. But I disagree. One important part of scholarship is the ability to choose the right quotation from the right source at the right time. And I think it was entirely appropriate to use it for the purposes of confronting modernity and its supposedly enlightened, in my view, confused, view of gender roles. One reason I wanted to present Evola untrammeled, that is, without me kind of in the way, is because had I simply paraphrased, I would have likely introduced errors into his system. In fact, my own script for the video did err from Evola's teachings by using the term satanic. Evola was not a dualist, while Satan belongs to the realm of religious dualism. So I was mixing my tradition, so to speak, a newbie error. But then, as anyone in the know about such things already knows, theology is not exactly my strongest suit. Evola rejected dialogue with modernity. He affirmed absolute, non-negotiable values as capital T truth. And he saw man's chief duty, much like Socrates or Plato, as cultivation of one's soul. By introducing the note of Christian good versus evil, I strayed from the perennialist teachings, which simply contrast tradition with modernity or anti-tradition, solar civilizations with lunar civilizations, aristocratic values with plebeian values, and the old caste system with democracy. I would accept as valid criticism that by speaking in terms of good versus evil, I had gone beyond what Evola, who was much influenced by Nietzsche and German idealism, would have said. This was my fault, and not his, or that of any Christian denomination. The tension between Evola and Christianity, in fact, is very real, and is yet to be fully resolved in my own thinking. I do not yet understand the nuances of this tension and need to learn more, which requires reading. Which brings me to the next charge, that of cherry-picking. Now, there is a fallacy in inductive reasoning called selective evidence, letting the hypothesis control the data by ignoring all of the examples which would disprove or complicate it. Now, is drawing on a well-known authority on traditionalism like Evola to articulate the traditional view of gender roles an example of selective evidence? First, there's another question. Who else but a traditionalist can articulate the traditional view of gender roles? Can a feminist articulate the traditional view? Most feminists today are materialists, or sometimes they belong to an older tradition of Freudian psychoanalysis. You know, there's the Freudian type of feminist as well. How could a materialist or a Freudian ever articulate the traditional view of gender roles? Thus, for this to be an example of cherry-picking, there'd have to be significant disagreement among the traditionalists. I hope you can see why this is the case. It's no good asking Marxists, liberals, feminists, postmodernists, and so on for their approximations of what the traditional view was, since they are operating entirely outside the epistemological framework of tradition. The answer must come from within it. Now, were I writing an academic dissertation rather than a YouTube video, I might have done a longer field survey of traditionalists on gender roles. For example, Evola disagreed with Otto Weininger, who is a big influence on his view on men and women. In his book-length study on men and women, Eros and the Mysteries of Love, Evola notes that Weininger seems to be more radical in asserting not only that woman has no soul, but also that she has no ego or being, and in declaring the decisive factor between masculinity and femininity to be the possession or lack of being. So Evola departs from this view, maintaining that tradition shows Weininger to be in error and that women have pathways to cultivate the soul available to them, as he outlined. Alas, YouTube videos seldom leave us time for such nuance, but had I the time, I would scour the works of René Guénon, De Maistre, Carlyle, and others to see how other traditionalist thinkers conceived of the relationship between the sexes. So perhaps by choosing Evola and Evola alone, I may, stress may, have been guilty of providing incomplete information, but only because I did not have the time to do a full field survey. Note, though, that all authors I might have consulted would have been traditionalists or reactionaries, not conservatives, as Adam or Stitch might think of them. Throughout the stream, Stitch defaulted to imagining a boomer-con vision of 1950s America, but this came from not knowing that he was dealing with a traditionalist, not a standard conservative. The difference is articulated by Evola later in Eros and the Mysteries of Love. He says, we will leave aside altogether the problems of woman and of sexual relations as people think of them nowadays in relation to marriage, divorce, emancipation, free love, and so on. These are all spurious problems. The only true problem is to what extent in a given society, an epoch, man can be himself and woman can be herself in an accurate approximation of their respective archetypes. And also, to what extent the relationships of man and woman reflect the natural and unchangeable law rooted in the very metaphysics of male and female. This law is reciprocal integration and completion together with a subordination of the female principle to the male. Everything else, as Nietzsche would say, is nonsense. And in the introduction we observed in what a state the modern Western world find itself in relation to man, woman, and sex, thanks to our so-called progress. So he was always thinking about something much deeper than divorce rates, freedom for women trapped in bad marriages, and all of the other usual metrics to which Adam and Stitch defaulted time and again in their reaction to the passage I quoted. This is the difference between standard, rank, low politics and the orientation of traditionalist high metapolitics, which looks at the problem at a higher and more spiritual level. A level at which Adam and Stitch on the stream were simply not equipped or ready to deal with, which is perhaps why they came off very badly to many viewers. I do not blame them for this, since it is very difficult for liberals to confront untrammeled traditionalism of this type, as I noted earlier. And that will conclude the first part of my response to Adam and Stitch. I aim to answer just two of Adam's charges at length. In further videos, I will address other topics. As ever, do pick up a course at the academic agency. There's a sale going on right now. Autumn 25 gets you 25% off everything except for foundations of research. And I'll see you again. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out. Welcome to part two of my response to Adam and Sitch, who spent almost 6 hours responding to my video, Zoomers Are Coomers, which was about the importance of maintaining traditional gender norms. In the first part, I justified my use of Julius Evola as a key source in making my argument. In this part, I'm going to focus on Adam and Sitch's continual need to shift focus from the argument itself to psychological matters, whether to question the personal and sexual motivations of me or of my sources. In fact, since this whole episode began, I have been called many names and accused of being either gay or terrified of strong women, with calls ringing out of insecure all over the place. I have been subject to a lot of attempted mockery, all of which, of course, failed to register as anything but the childish mewlings of Peter Pan men, for reasons that I will outline presently. In fact, whether it has been on my own videos or on those who made reaction videos, the majority of those watching have instinctively sided with me rather than with my liberal interlocutors. But this is only because I have deep knowledge of how to counter subversive leftist tactics from my years of being online. First, though, let us watch a small highlight reel of Adam and Sitch engaged in amateur psychologizing.
Look at that guy. You know this guy's a fucking boomer. Look at him. They didn't even have color photography when this picture was
taken. I mean, does that guy really look like the embodiment of masculinity? Look.
All I'm saying is,
I could take that guy in a fight. Look at him. Guy looks like
my.
This is hilarious. This is super key. Okay. He said the two paths of, like, you know, self-accusation for being a perfect man or whatever is either the path of action or the path of contemplation. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
And he's got the warrior and the aestheticist, you know, the guy that works on your nails. Okay. So Why do you think this guy who's not a warrior
picked being an academic as one of the paths to success for men?
Why would that be an option?
The men have two successful paths. Right. One is to be the alpha male warrior, and one just happens to coincide to be the thing that I am, the contemplator.
Excellent point. Excellent point. Yeah.
Give me a, this is like the Greek philosopher saying we all need to be ruled by the philosopher kings. Okay.
God,
like,
I would love to see the fucking anime ab bitch just slap this guy around.
Like, come on.
I want to see him fucking dunk on this guy right and left.
Like, if I'm appealing to like the like nature and talking about being a macho man Randy Savage here, I do not think of like the monk who sits alone in their fucking hovel contemplating the nature of existence and God is not, that's not a masculine behavior in my eyes. Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's not a bad thing. It's a good thing, but it's not like a gendered masculine behavior.
I think the point to make about vanguardism is
this fucking player right here. Yeah. Talk to me about your wife's fucking personal trainer.
I just love this fucking schlub. This is like one of the most beta male Napoleon Dynamite looking motherfuckers ever.
Yeah.
He's like, we need to go back to traditional masculine gender roles. Like, okay, you first, buddy.
Yeah.
First,
all you guys in the chat that are saying we're straw manning AA. I want you to
look at this guy.
I want you to listen very closely to this guy's dating advice because you're going to need it.
Yeah. Like, look, this is like the Jordan Peterson clean your room first, bucko. Okay. Before I try to clean the world, I clean your room. Before you start whining about traditional masculine gender roles, fucking don't look like this motherfucker.
In fairness to this poor guy, I mean, this video is probably from 40
years
ago.
This guy is saying that liberalism is evil. Not liberals, liberalism.
Well,
I'm just saying fuck him hard in the ass.
I'm just saying
this is the guy that the prisoners would throw around and bang because they think he's a chick. Like, give me a break here.
I'm just saying that, look, this video was filmed in 4:3, okay? 30 years ago when this video was made, this might have been the fashion, okay?
I don't want some fucking beta male motherfucker telling me what's up about we need to return to masculine times, okay? And that liberalism is evil. Bitch, if it wasn't for liberalism, this fucking guy would have got murdered all of his property stolen by some buff Chad warlord.
Okay? Totally. Genghis Khan would have had his way with this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
There's definitely
Genghis Khan would have taken his wife and his mom.
And him!
Yeah, probably.
Now, whether or not they did it consciously, Adam and Sitch in particular, it has to be said, defaulted to the mode of psychoanalysis when looking to counter the arguments. He personalized the issue, he questioned the manhood of both Evler and Bowden, he cast skepticism on their intellectual honesty and their motivations, based on perceived psychological traits and repressed desires. And this has long been a tactic of leftist subversives, going right back to the inception of psychoanalysis, as, along with Marxism, with which it often fused, one of the principal attack vectors through which the left have subverted practically every social and moral norm Western civilization once had. I am sure that Adam and Sitch were not even conscious of the extent to which they had internalized not only its method, but also its normative moral framework. So I'm going to briefly look at, first, the psychoanalytical method, second, the psychoanalytical moral framework, third, the metaphysical consequences of psychoanalysis, and fourth, the tactics of Saul Alinsky, which I believe Adam and Sitch have also internalized without even realizing it. So, I am sure you are all aware of psychoanalysis in the Freudian sense, and I will not run down the basics here. What is important from our point of view is how Adam and Sitch and many other liberals constantly use psychoanalysis as a means of getting out of confronting the chief argument at stake. It provides, as Thomas Sowell once put it in The Vision of the Anointed, arguments without argument. How? Well, first consider at the most basic level. By moving to psychoanalyze, we have already moved from engaging with the text to the subtext. and from what is said to what is not said. This is a leftist tactic that Adam and Sitch would note and call out in many other contexts, I am sure, because if you're focusing on what is not said, you are quite literally substituting their argument for one of your own. And this very often boils down to refusing to engage with the argument that was actually made and instead guessing at the motive of the author. And I hope you can see that Sitch did this continuously. But this is an issue because when he engages in this sort of debate tactic, that is, when he employs psychoanalysis, something more insidious is happening too. Without realizing it, he is internalizing and regurgitating its basic view of humanity, as well as its basic moral norms. This is what made it such a successful tool of subversion. Just by using it alone, you acquiesce to some of its deeper and more hidden arguments. What do I mean by this? Well, as Maurice Blondel once put it, Freud saw the pig in the man and made man a sad pig. For in reducing humans down to the level of their basest desires at the level of sex, Freud practically eliminated any sense of the transcendent on which traditional morality and metaphysics rested. But it is worse than that. As the Marxist Herbert Marcuse codified it in his book Eros and Civilization, in the Freudian framework, sexual liberation, which is to say emancipation from any social restrictions on sex, was seen as the only path to self-actualization. I will talk more about liberal conceptions of freedom and self-actualization in the next part, but here it is worth noting how easily and quickly Adam and Sitch found themselves putting forward the psychoanalytical view of self-actualization without even realizing it. In psychoanalysis, sublimation inhibits the realization of your true self, which is found in the realization of suppressed desire. Sublimation, which is to say the bad old structures and institutions and religions of society, transmutes immediate to delayed satisfaction, pleasure to restraint of pleasure, joy or play to toil or work, receptiveness to productiveness, and the absence of repression to security. Whenever a liberal attacks a conservative who is against, let's say, homosexuality on the basis that they are secretly in the closet themselves, they are speaking the language and occupying the moral framework of psychoanalysis. This is important because this moral framework, which is normative, is the exact inverse of tradition, which placed self-control and stoical values at a premium. Whenever a liberal defends quote-unquote kink, they are assuming that it is undoubtedly a good thing that the desire is brought to the surface rather than quote-unquote suppressed, that giving in to the desire is the path to self-actualization rather than maintaining control. And incidentally, self-control, which in its highest form is mastery, has always been seen as a masculine ideal, which again is completely subverted and inverted when it is imagined that a man can only find himself when he succumbs to his desires. Now, Evola, in both Eros and the Mysteries of Love and a fascinating essay called Freedom of Sex and Freedom from Sex, does not at all assert that tradition was prudish about sex or that sex is some morally bad thing in and of itself. In fact, for him, sex can be elevated to a spiritual level. It can be deeply profound. But he does not want it reduced to vulgarity or what he called mere orgiastic discharge, which is what psychoanalysis does to sex and, by extension, to mankind itself. And in the modern world, sex has become reduced to its most vulgar, bestial, and profane aspect. In his view, a man needs to be in control of sex and not let it control him. We all know the phrase, he's thinking with his dick, or similar such phrases. So some aspect of this older view of sex endures in however warped a way, even today. Avila is not talking about profane things like who happens to go on top and other such issues. Let's not forget that he also wrote a book on Tantra, but rather the state of mind and spirit with which a man enters sexual union. Consider how far modern gender roles have strayed from the old ideal. Now, Herbert Marcuse recognized that constraints against the sex instinct were absolutely paramount for the defense of civilization. But naturally, as a Marxist, he wanted to bring that civilization down and, in a Rousseauian sense, free humans from the bonds of that civilization. He said, "The concept of man that emerges from Freudian theory is the most irrefutable indictment of Western civilization and, at the same time, the most unshakable defense of this civilization. According to Freud, the history of man is the history of his repression. Culture constrains not only his societal, but also his biological existence, not only parts of the human being, but his instinctual structure itself. However, such constraint is the very precondition of progress. Left free to pursue their natural objectives, the basic instincts of man would be incompatible with all lasting associations and preservation. They would destroy even where they unite. The uncontrolled Eros is just as fatal as his deadly counterpart, the death instinct. Their destructive force derives from the fact that they strive for a gratification which culture cannot grant, gratification as such and as an end in itself at any moment. The instincts must therefore be deflected from their goal, inhibited in their aim. Civilization begins when the primary objective, namely integral satisfaction of needs, is effectively renounced." And so the avowed enemies of Western civilization saw sex, the arena of sex, the norms of sex, including, of course, gender roles, as absolutely essential to its defense. So, of course, they would attack there. And so successful has their attack been that scarcely 75 years after Marcuse, a radical socialist, wrote this, self-proclaimed enlightened centrists, such as Adam and Sitch, deny the very possibility that sexual norms were important to civilization at all, let alone that their destruction might lead to its ruin. I would suggest that they have internalized every subversion made by the likes of Marcuse to our culture. Kerry Bolton, who has recently published an interesting, perhaps even definitive book on this topic called The Perversion of Normality, describes the process by which the nominally socialist project of Marcuse and his colleagues ended up becoming a driving force of capitalism. Marcuse et al. Claimed to be rejecting conventional society and rebelling against capitalism. However, the self-indulgent, unrestrained individualism that demands immediate ego gratification and objects to any form of delayed satisfaction as a result of repression, oppression, suppression, racism, misogyny, or homophobia ad infinitum became the ideology of capitalism. The expectation of immediate satisfaction is the basis for ever-expanding markets. He goes on to show how Edward Bernays and others cynically used the tools of psychoanalysis to sell suppressed desires back to the American populace as product, and in 2021 tried to divorce somebody like Short Fat Otaku from one of those products, or tell him that there should be any limit to his kinks or his most basic instincts or desires. And hark what discord will follow. We have seen the total victory of Freud, Marcuse, and Bernays over traditional notions of self-control. As Francis Parker Yockey put it, in Freudianism, the meaning of human life is sexuality, actual, optative, conative, or otherwise. Culture man is the spiritual enemy. He must be eliminated by animalizing him, biologizing him, making him economic, sexualizing him, diabolizing him. The last great attempt to animalize man also uses critical rationalistic methods. The soul is mechanical. It consists of one simple impulse, the sexual instinct. The various processes are neurosis, inversion, complexes, repression, sublimation, transference, perversion. All are abnormal, unhealthy, misdirected, unnatural. As one of the Abbasidarian truths, the system states that every person is a neurotic and every neurotic is a pervert or invert. This applies not only to culture man, but to primitive man as well. As we struggle to convince people like this that there should be normative gender roles, as we watch men debase themselves and succumb to the cheapest fantasies in public on a daily basis, I would suggest that culture man has been almost entirely eliminated. We are now at a point where perversion is worn as a badge of pride and affirmed as a positive identity. And this brings me to my final point, which is that Adam and Sitch, despite essentially supporting and openly avowing the program of Marcuse and friends, whether or not they realized they were doing so, continuously and disingenuously tried to hold Evola himself, as well as Jonathan Bowden, to some imagined standard of masculinity. Now, because their conception of the world is entirely materialistic, base and profane, their only framework for ascertaining masculinity was the idea of the Chad, who sleeps with a lot of women and who can handle himself in a fight. In fact, Evola himself somewhat prompted this in an essay in the late 1960s when he discussed masculinity in contemporary America. He said, equally correct is DeMarchi's analysis of American mores and the profound unease that, all appearances aside, plagues life in the United States as far as sex is concerned. The origin of this trouble lies in the early puritanical conception, which idolized women on a sexophobic basis. As late as the Victorian period, women were conceived as a superior spiritual being. The supposition that women could experience sexual emotions or yield to them and derive pleasure from them was considered insulting. A cliché of dignity and loftiness was thus imposed on women, who accepted it. In conjunction with female emancipation, this gave rise to a host of sexually inhibited, half-anesthetized and frustrated beings, who find their counterpart in the materialist male that lets himself be dominated by women and respects them in the most inane sense of the term, or, as a reaction, conforms to the stereotype of the tough guy, of the violent man, or of the gangster surrounded by babes. Hence the lack of any meaningful encounter between the two parts, the two sexes. Hence too a series of counterbalances and outbursts, starting from the excesses of the beatniks, alcohol abuse, the frenzied enthusiasm for jazz, and so on, which only worsen the situation. Interesting, isn't it, that we get the materialist male who lets himself be dominated by women and respects them in the most inane sense of the term, and we get the stereotypical guy surrounded by babes, which is the image of masculinity that Adam and Sitch return to time and again. Sitch even suggested that Evola was writing because he could not get women to sleep with him and called him an incel. He belittled Jonathan Bowden and suggested that he could not be taken seriously because he did not live up to whatever idea of masculinity he had in his mind. Now, I'm sure a lot of people would want me to point out details like, for example, Evola served in World War I. He was known for going out walking during bomb raids. He devoted himself to pursuits like mountain climbing and fencing. But all of these details are actually irrelevant, because let's just pretend for a second that Evola was, the Chad, or if he was, let's say, a Bronze Age pervert style lifter, you know, they would have found some other vector of attack. Like, I'm sure that Sitch would have said something like, oh, yes, of course, but that's feminine behavior, or something like that. But the point is, it doesn't actually matter, because this is not really what they were up to when they were making these attacks. Given that they were occupying the position that normative gender roles should not be promoted or enforced in our society, it's obvious that they had no actual basis from which to make these attacks. Rather, they were, again, whether they knew it or not, engaged in Alinsky tactics, those devised by the activist Saul Alinsky in the 70s. Let us remind ourselves, the fourth rule is, according to Alinsky, make the enemy live up to their own book of rules. You can kill them with this, for they can no more obey their own rules than the Christian church can live up to Christianity. The fourth rule carries within it the fifth rule. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. It is almost impossible to counterattack ridicule. It also infuriates the opposition, who then react to your advantage. These tools, making them live up to their own rules, and ridicule, absolutely smashed and destroyed the toothless, unprepared boomercon right at the cultural level. Alinsky was almost entirely successful in his subversion of American Christian culture, which seemed powerless in the face of these tactics. But naturally, they're not going to work today in 2021 against those of us on the right who are wise to these tactics, and attempts to use them against someone like me will backfire monumentally, as Adam and Sitch have found in the past week. And so ends this part of my little response season here. Next time, I will get on to the more substantive issues of freedom and self-actualization, which are at the core of my disagreement with these leftists who call themselves centrists. Let me know what you think in the comments. Remember, there's a sale going on at the academic agency. If you use the code AUTUMN25, you get 25% off all courses, apart from Foundations of Research. And I'll see you next time. Be sure to like this video and subscribe, and if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out. This is part 3 of my response to Adam and Sitch's review of my video Zoomers Are Coomers. The first 2 parts are focused chiefly on matters of form, that is, on issues prior to the argument itself. Today I want to focus on the content, or if you prefer, the meat of what is at stake here, namely, differing notions of freedom and their potential consequences for society. First, let's take a look at another little highlight reel.
This is a better way to structure society. I disagree with you, okay? Because I've read other people other than this fucking moron that you picked a tweet from. Quote from history, okay?
Think of some, you need to read some anti-liberalism thinkers, okay? Then you'll understand. Then your natural biological moral intuitions will feel justified, basically.
we're getting rid of anime because it's what's good for them.
Now, to get a grip on this issue, we need to define what freedom means. I posit that there are 3 definitions of freedom in play here. First, the traditional definition of freedom as self-control of reason's triumph over the passions. This is broadly the one that I and some of my the people I've drawn from, like Julius Evola, have had in play. Second, there is the classical liberal definition of freedom as freedom from interference, also known as the non-aggression principle. This is the one employed by libertarians, typically. And third, there is the modern liberal definition of freedom as the ability to do whatever one likes. Now, let us deal with these latter two first, which I believe Adam and Sitch seem to switch between almost interchangeably throughout the stream. There is much confusion between the classical liberal notion of freedom and the modern liberal notion of freedom. To classical liberalism, an individual is said to be free if left to his or her own devices. In modern liberalism, meanwhile, freedom is the agent's ability to do whatever he likes. This latter idea is a concept taken from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, that man is truly free who desires what he is able to perform and does what he desires. Direct quotation. Rousseau was a romantic utopian thinker, and his line of thought has no place in the classical liberal tradition, and it forms the basis of both modern liberalism and Marxist notions of freedom. As Isaiah Berlin put it in a seminal essay, Rousseau's definition of freedom, later adopted by John Stuart Mill, will not do for classical liberals. Freedom for classical liberals is hence, as Berlin suggests in that same essay, the absence of coercion or violence. I am free to walk down the street so long as I do not punch you in the face, and vice versa. Some have called this definition of liberty the non-aggression principle, which has its origin in John Locke. You are free to own a property for which you can afford to pay, whether upfront or through mortgage repayments. You are free to get a job, to exchange your time and labor for money. You are free to use your money to buy food and clothing, or do whatever else with it. However, you are not entitled to a property. You are not entitled to a job, food, or clothing. It is not incumbent on anyone else to provide you with those things, and strictly speaking, the failure of everyone else to buy you a house or give you a job, food, and clothing is not at all a violation of your freedom. Naturally, should you by your own efforts acquire these things, your range of possible choices, that is, your power to act in certain ways, will increase, assuming that nothing else has changed. Even though your power has increased, in this case, your liberty has remained constant. You were as free before you had the house, the job, the food, the clothing, and so on, as you are now that you have acquired all of those things. To use the terminology of Ludwig von Mises, you have substituted a more satisfactory state of affairs for one that is less satisfactory because you desired conditions which suit you better. Your actions aimed at bringing about this desired state. The incentive that impels a man to act is always some uneasiness, according to Mises. Classical liberals, then, see modern liberals and leftists as confusing freedom with power. Murray N. Rothbard usefully distinguishes between power over nature and power over man. He says it is easy to see that an individual's power is his ability to control his environment in order to satisfy his wants. A man with an axe has the power to chop down a tree. A man with a factory has the power, along with other complementary factors, to produce capital goods. A man with a gun has the power to force an unarmed man to do his bidding, provided that the unarmed man chooses not to resist or not to accept his death at gunpoint. It should be clear that there is a basic distinction between the two types of power. Power over nature is the sort of power on which civilization must be built. The record of man's history is the record of the advance or attempted advance of that power. Power over men, on the other hand, does not raise the general standard of living or promote the satisfactions of all, as does power over nature. The concept of human rights, tainted by Rousseauian thinking, fundamentally confuses freedom and power. In fact, in many cases, human rights violate liberty by using the power over men embodied in the state to coerce individuals to sacrifice their power over nature for the benefit of others. As Paul L. Poirot put it in 1962, human rights are more properly defined as special privileges conferred upon some persons at the expense of others. And I would say that Friended and Sitch spent almost the entirety of their, 11-hour video trapped in the paradigm of the classical liberal versus the modern liberal way of thinking, all of which is entirely materialistic in its orientation. But now let us come to the traditional definition of freedom, which is perhaps a little more alien to some of the people watching this. I will turn to Mortimer J. Adler, summarizing the thoughts of St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. In the theory of Augustine and Aquinas, the virtuous man is morally or spiritually free because human reason has triumphed in its conflict with the passions to influence the free judgment of his will. The rule of reason does not annul the will's freedom, nor is the will less free when it is moved by the promptings of the passions. A passion, writes Aquinas, cannot draw or move the will directly. It does so indirectly, as, for example, when those who are in some kind of passion do not easily turn their imagination away from the object of their affections. But though the will is not altered in its freedom by whether reason or emotion dominates, the situation is not the same with the person as a whole. The theologians see him as a moral agent and a spiritual being who gains or loses freedom as the will submits to the guidance of reason or follows the passions. In this conception, giving in to the passions entails a loss of freedom, while overriding them with reason entails a gain of freedom. This is the sense of Augustine's famous quotation, "Therefore, the good man is free, even if he is a slave, whereas the bad man is a slave, even if he reigns. A slave, not to one man, but, what is worse, to as many masters as he has vices." This is the exact reverse of the normative moral framework of Freudian psychoanalysis, as outlined by Herbert Marcuse, that I discussed in the last part, and to which Adam Friended and PSA Sitch seem to default in their video. Now, for those of you who might be quick to dismiss this as nothing but Christian zeal rather than ancient wisdom, bear in mind here that Augustine is echoing quite directly the philosopher Seneca, who was writing for about 400 years before Augustine in the Roman Stoic tradition. This is Seneca now. "He is a slave. His soul, however, may be that of a free man. He is a slave, but shall that stand in his way? Show me a man who is not a slave. One is a slave to lust, another to greed, another to ambition, and all men are slaves to fear. I will name you an ex-consul who is a slave to an old hag, a millionaire who is a slave to a serving maid. I will show you youths of the noblest birth in serfdom to pantomime players. No servitude is more disgraceful than that which is self-imposed." And Seneca's ideas around this sense of freedom themselves can be traced back 400 years before him to Aristotle, whose notion of eudaimonia is rooted in self-mastery and self-control to cultivate good habits. And we can actually trace this back even further to his mentor Plato, who has his own teacher, Socrates, tell us that self-actualization can be found in combining the dictum, know thyself, with the dictum, nothing in excess. So, we have a tradition from Socrates in around 380 BC, let's say, to Thomas Aquinas in the 1270s, which had an acceptance of this idea of freedom. We're talking about, 1,500 years, just in that stretch from Socrates to Aquinas. But then we can range forward to Immanuel Kant in the 18th century. And let us consider this passage from The Metaphysics of Morals in 1797. This is Kant now. "Man has a duty to cultivate his natural powers, powers of spirit, mind, and body, as means to all sorts of possible ends. Man owes it to himself as a rational being, not to leave idle, as it were, rusting away the natural predispositions and capacities that his reason can some day use. Even supposing that he could be satisfied with the innate scope of his capacities for his natural needs, his reason must first show him by principles that this meagre scope of his capabilities is satisfactory. For as a being capable of ends, of making objects his ends, he must owe the use of his powers not merely to natural instinct, but rather to the freedom by which he determines their scope. Hence, the basis on which man should develop his capabilities for all sorts of ends is not regard for the advantages that their cultivation can provide. For the advantage might, according to Rousseau's principles, turn out on the side of his prude natural needs. Instead, it is a command of morally practical reason and a duty of man to himself to cultivate his capacities, some among them more than others, insofar as men have different ends, and to be, in a pragmatic respect, a man equal to the end of his existence." Now, this is a lengthy and somewhat convoluted passage, to be sure, and I think the fault of that lies partly with the translator rather than Kant, but the thrust of this passage is saying substantially the same thing as Aristotle, Seneca, Augustine, or Aquinas. The primacy of reason over the passions to cultivate virtuous habits through which freedom finds its ultimate expression. Kant goes on to outline some of the ways in which someone might do this. So first we have powers of spirit, which are those whose exercise is possible only through reason. They are creative to the extent that their use is not drawn from experience, but rather derived from a priori principles of the sort to be found in mathematics, logic, and the metaphysics of nature. The latter two are also included in philosophy, namely theoretical philosophy, which does not then mean wisdom, as the word itself would suggest, but only science. However, theoretical philosophy can help to promote the end of wisdom. And then there are powers of mind, which are those that are at the disposal of understanding and the rule it uses to fulfill whatever purposes one might have. And because of this, experience is their guide. They include memory, imagination, and the like, on which can be built learning, taste, internal and external embellishment, and so forth, which furnish instruments for a variety of purposes. Finally, cultivating the powers of the body, gymnastics in the strict sense, is looking after the basic stuff, the matters of man, without which he could not realize his ends. Hence, the continuing and purposive invigoration of the animal in man is an end of man that is a duty to himself. Now, this conception of self-actualization, as articulated by Kant, runs straight through Hegel, who imbued it with an oddly communitarian flavor, to Friedrich Nietzsche, who then somewhat tried to rebel against it, and beyond him, both Abraham Maslow and his famous hierarchy of needs, and Carl Jung, and indeed beyond them, to perhaps the world's most famous Jungian today, and the man who Adam Friended made the center of his entire channel at one point, Jordan P. Peterson. Now, it's strange what a picture of a man with a monocle can do to people. But Julius Evola's ethics and his notion of freedom as realized in self-actualization can be seen as straightforwardly coming out of the same tradition. The issue where Evola is concerned is that modernity has made self-actualization all but impossible in the West. Materialism and secularization have done tremendous damage to Western culture as well as to the Western individual and the individual's mind, which is why he looked to Eastern traditions such as Hindu yoga and Buddhism as means by which to achieve self-actualization. And his system of self-mastery is incredibly flexible. He chose it to be available to practically anyone, so long as they had the aristocratic soul, as he might put it, to be able to go through with it. You can get there using any number of paths, including the so-called wet path of action. His books, The Yoga of Power and Men Among the Ruins, are about this, and the so-called dry path of contemplation. His book, The Doctrine of the Awakening, as well as Ride the Tiger, are both about this. Now, contrary to how it may seem, much of Evola's project was to cleanse these traditional systems of silly modern notions of mysticism, spiritualism, and occultism, which had crept into the discourse over the 19th and early 20th centuries. He wanted to ensure that the available paths were both authentic and effective. But Evola's specific project is somewhat besides the main overarching point here, the point of real disagreement between Sitch and me and Friended and me, which is that thinkers from Socrates to Kant conceived of freedom as the ability of the rational mind to master the passions. If you let the passions rule you, you are not free because you are being ruled by them. And thus we return to the original problem of the Kuma question. When someone is addicted to porn, are they free? In the liberal idea of Friended and Sitch, freedom is something like the unhampered ability to choose to watch porn or not to watch porn. Whereas in the ancient tradition, as well as its modern manifestations, freedom is the unhampered ability to override your desire to watch porn rather than give into that desire. If you cannot overcome that desire, then are you choosing the porn? Or is the porn choosing you? If your society and its laws leaves you completely vulnerable to being overwhelmed by your own basest instincts, while offering no guidance whatsoever in terms of overcoming them, is that truly representative of freedom? What chance does the individual have to achieve self-mastery in such a state of affairs? The deck is stacked against even the possibility of doing so for all but the rarest of people, and I'm talking less than 5%. I'll leave you to ponder that one. Before the next part of my series, which concerns the extent to which we are facing steep civilizational decline or collapse, I'm going to pause my own contributions briefly to hand over to my buddy, Red Hawk, who comes from a more evolutionary perspective and has a good number of points to make about the differences between men and women that seem to have been overlooked by Friended and Sitch. This should be considered an additional response on top of my own four-part mini-series, but I will list it as part of the main playlist. All right, let me know what you think in the comments. I'll see you next time. Remember, I have a sale going on at the moment at the academic agency. Autumn 25 will get you 25% off all courses, apart from Foundations of Research, which is one of the ones you really need. But, you know, I'm practically giving it away. So do pick up one of those, and I'll see you next time. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out. This is the fourth and final part of my response to Adam Friended and PSA Sitch, although there is an additional episode made by my friend Red Hawk on the differences between men and women, which you should also check out. The previous parts have covered why it is worth reading old authors and quoting from them. That was part one. Why the move to psychoanalyze your opposition in debates is a tool of leftist subversion. That was part two. And why I have asserted the view of freedom as self-actualization. That was part three. In this part, I want to focus on the topic of civilizational decline and collapse, which Adam and Sitch seemed absolutely to deny is taking place today, or even that the possibility of collapse might take place soon, simply because of the fact that it has been warned of for some decades now. Just to make sure that you understand that I'm not making these things up, that I'm not strawmanning the opposition, let's hear some highlights of them saying these things with their own mouths on their stream from last week.
See, I fucking hate this too. I totally hate this. It's like,
I mean, sure, that's true, but that's a good thing. The liberal waters we've swam in have created the most successful, best society the world has ever produced.
They're saying Steel Man AA's argument, but I mean, AA's argument
I did like
is
20 times.
AA's argument is that society is on the verge of collapse. I mean, how do we, like, what?
AA's argument is that subverting and reversing gender roles
has led us to a near societal collapse. Okay, I look out my
window, or will lead to some societal harm.
And I look out my window, and I just don't see the near fucking societal collapse. And where I do see it potentially, I don't see it as a product of subverting gender roles.
Adam, your state is going to be on fire, okay? And that's because all the firemen are really fire women.
Man, this is so weird. I want to answer this question. In the chat, someone has said, Adam is living in California and can't see the collapse. This is so bizarre because this argument should tell you something, okay? You guys are being sold this fucking California is about to fall in the ocean lie. Okay.
Yes.
I can take you plenty of places in California where it's very nice, where we have excellent weather and things are going swimmingly. Okay. Mm-hmm. The idea that California is on the verge of fucking collapse is.
The problem is people don't know their history. They don't know that 20 years ago, everyone was saying the same thing.
Yeah,
30 years ago, empire's on decline.
50 years ago.
It's about to collapse.
Yes.
And then 20 years before that, they were saying, oh, the American empire's on decline. It's about to collapse. And then 20 years before that, they're saying, oh, the American empire's on decline. Like, this is just This is what happens.
Yes.
This is the psychology, okay? Every generation, there's going to be the people who look back to the past and think things were better then, and they're going to feel like we're towards the decline. Mm-hmm. So you have this perpetual fear that we're always on the edge of decline.
Now, it would be true to say that I took the causal link between moral and civilizational decline, which includes men acting as women, as self-evident in my original video, and did not at all flesh this out. And I'm going to explain why I see that link as self-evident in this video. First, I have two premises on which my conclusion is drawn. I'll write it out as a logical syllogism. All civilizations that lose their moral center collapse. Our civilization has lost its moral center. Therefore, our civilization will collapse. I take the minor premise here that our civilization has lost its moral center to be absolutely self-evident. And as such, I don't believe that anyone watching this, including Adam and Sitch, would disagree on this point. That means I need to prove the major premise, which is that moral collapse will cause civilizational collapse. And for this, it will be necessary to go on a little history lesson. But in drawing on history, I have a hidden assumption which can be expressed as follows. Human nature does not change from one era to the next. The events of the past are the result of human nature. Therefore, the events of the past can give us guidance today. Again, I hold this as self-evident, but PSA Sitch spent a decent portion of the stream pointing to the fact that what counts as masculinity has changed from one era to the next. Here, Thomas Sowell provides a useful summary of what typically splits conservatives and progressives. He says, "The issue is not as to whether changes have occurred in human history, but whether these are, in effect, changes of costumes and scenery or changes of the play itself. In the constrained vision, it is mostly the costumes and scenery that have changed. In the unconstrained vision, the play itself has changed. The characters are fundamentally different, and equally sweeping changes are both likely and necessary in the future." In other words, the progressive believes that human nature itself changes from one era to the next. If Adam and Sitch want to embrace such a view wholeheartedly, then they should do so openly. But somehow, given Sitch's comments here, I doubt that they do subscribe to the unconstrained vision.
I don't believe that you could socially condition people out of their biological behaviors.
That's why you got to take it away. You got to make the anime illegal.
But that's why I think, this is why I'm not worried about this, and I think this argument is silly. You can't, I don't think it's possible. I don't think you can condition people away to just ignore their biological impulses. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. It's not something that happens at all. What we do is we sublimate people's biological impulses into socially acceptable behaviors like team sports and playing video games. But you can't erase them and you can't invert them. Okay? You can have a bunch of college kids be confused about finding themselves, but guess what happens when they're out of college? Mm-hmm. They bounce right back. Okay.
So with all these caveats made, I want to take a look at some civilizations that have collapsed in the past. First, let us consider the Persian conquest of Babylon, which took place around 539 BC. Here is how Herodotus recorded it. Owing to the vast size of the place, the inhabitants of the central parts, as the residents at Babylon declare, long after the outer portions of the town were taken, knew nothing of what had chanced, but as they were engaged in a festival, continued dancing and revelling until they learnt the capture but too certainly. Such, then, were the circumstances of the first taking of Babylon. Incidentally, this is mentioned in the Bible, in the book of Daniel. Herodotus also mentions that when Darius the Great laid siege to the city, the Babylonians had sunk to such moral bankruptcy that the men strangled all the women to ensure that there was enough food for themselves. The point, however, is that when collapse came for Babylon, many inhabitants were entirely unaware that it had even taken place. Which reminds me a little of Adam Friended sitting in California. But then what became of the Persians when they, in turn, were defeated by the Greeks under Alexander the Great? According to Xenophon, after the death of Cyrus the Great, everything began to deteriorate, especially in the reign of King Cambyses. Plato remarked, the royal heirs had a womanish rearing by royal women lately grown rich. They were without training in their father's craft, which was a hard one. For to turn out shepherds of great strength, able to camp out in the open and to keep watch and, if need be, go campaigning. He overlooked the fact, he's talking about King Cambyses here, that his sons were trained by women and eunuchs, and that the indulgence shown them as heaven's darlings had ruined their training. And Plato goes on. So when, at the death of Cyrus, his sons took over the kingdom, overpampered and undisciplined as they were, first the one killed the other through annoyance at his being put on an equality with himself, and presently, being mad with drink and debauchery, he lost his own throne at the hands of Medes, under the man, then called the eunuch, who despised the stupidity of Cambyses. This ultimately led to the usurpation of the throne by Darius the Great, a great man in Thomas Carlyle's sense, but ultimately Darius could not stop the rot alone, and the trappings of luxury and opulence came to devour the empire. At the time of the Greeks' defeat of the Persians, Isocrates commented on their once glorious and near undefeatable army. And this is Isocrates. It seems to me that in every quarter the Persians have clearly exposed their degeneracy. For along the coast of Asia they have been defeated in many battles, and when they crossed to Europe they were duly punished, either perishing miserably or saving their lives with dishonour. And to crown all, they made themselves objects of derision under the very walls of their king's palace. And he goes on, really, to say that the defeat of the Persians had already taken place within their moral character and spirit. He says, and none of these things happened by accident, but all of them have been due to natural causes, for it is not possible for people who are reared and governed, as are the Persians, either to have a part in any other form of virtue, or to set up on the field of battle trophies of victory over their foes. For how could either an able general or a good soldier be produced amid such ways of life as theirs? Most of their population is a mob without discipline or experience of dangers, which has lost all stamina for war and has been trained more effectively for servitude than are the slaves in our country. The Greeks then themselves, despite the warnings of both Herodotus and Plato, endeavoured to throw their own empire away by embarking on a policy of multiculturalism. As W.W. Tarn put it, Greece was ready to adopt the gods of a foreigner, but the foreigner rarely reciprocated. Greek Dura, the Greek temple in Mesopotamia, freely admitted the gods of Babylon, but no Greek god entered the Babylonian Uruk. Foreign gods might take Greek names, they took little else. They, the Babylonian gods, were the stronger, and the conquest of Asia by the Greeks was bound to fail as soon as the East had gauged its own strength and Greek weakness. Polybius also pointed out, in our time all Greece was visited by a dearth of children and generally a decay of population, owing to which the cities were denuded of inhabitants, and a failure of productiveness resulted. Though there were no long-continued wars or pestilences among us, if, then, anyone had advised our sending to ask the gods in to regard this, what we were to do or say in order to become more numerous and better fill our cities, would he have not seemed a futile person when the cause was manifest and the cure in our own hands? For this evil grew upon us rapidly, and without attracting attention, by our men becoming perverted to a passion for show and money and the pleasures of an idle life, and accordingly either not marrying at all, or if they did marry, refusing to rear the children that were born, or at most one or two out of a great number for the sake of leaving them well off or bringing them up in extravagant luxury. For when there was only one or two sons, it is evident that if war or pestilences carries off one, the houses must be left airless, and like swarms of bees, little by little the cities become sparsely inhabited and weak. On this subject there is no need to ask the gods how we are to be relieved from such a curse, for anyone in the world will tell you that it is by the men themselves, if possible, changing their objects of ambition, or if that cannot be done, by passing laws for the preservation of infants. Now, as Carrie Bolton observed in The Decline and Fall of Civilization, from which I've taken many of these quotations thus far, by the way, he says this: the Greek elite eagerly embraced Persian extravagance. Persian dress, art, products, and aesthetics were associated with cultural status. This attitude seeped downwards among the masses. Xenophon satirized the way Persian austerity was given up to gluttony, drunkenness, and ease, even among the military. So that was the Greeks. Then, of course, came the Romans, who, imbued with Spartan spirit, were able to keep degeneracy at bay for longer than most. But eventually, even they fell through prolonged exposure to the moral laxness of their colonies. Thus of Antioch, Edward Gibbons wrote, "Fashion was the only law, pleasure the only pursuit, and the splendour of dress and furniture was the only distinction of the citizens of Antioch. The arts of luxury were honoured. The serious and manly virtues were the subject of ridicule, and the contempt for female modesty and reverent age announced the universal corruption of the capitals of the East." And then from contemporary accounts, here's Polybius again. "Some of the young Roman men had abandoned themselves to love affairs with boys, and others to consorting with prostitutes, and many to musical entertainments and banquets, and all of the extravagances that they entail, infected with Greek weakness during the war with Perseus. So great, in fact, was the permissiveness and hedonism among young men that paid a talent for a male lover, and others 300 drachma for a jar of caviar." Now, this aroused the indignation of Cato, who said once in a public speech that it was the surest sign of deterioration in the Republic when pretty boys fetch more than fields and jars of caviar more than ploughmen. It was just at the period we are treating of that this present tendency to extravagance declared itself. First of all, because they thought that now, after the fall of the Macedonian kingdom, their universal dominion was undisputed, and next because, after the riches of Macedonia had been transported to Rome, there was a great display of wealth, both in public and in private. Now, while it didn't happen all at once, the Roman ethos slowly petered out before, in the end, the empire scarcely had the will to hold itself together anymore, despite the efforts of certain great men. Now, much the same happened to the great Arabian Empire that lasted from 636 to 880 AD. As John Bagot Glubb put it, the works of contemporary historians of Baghdad in the early 10th century are still available. They deplored the degeneracy of the times in which they lived, emphasizing particularly the indifference to religion and increasing materialism and the laxity of sexual morals. They lamented also the corruption of the officials of the government and the fact that politicians always seemed to amass large fortunes while they were in office. And he continues, "The historians commented bitterly on the extraordinary influence acquired by popular singers over young people, resulting in a decline in sexual morality. The pop singers of Baghdad accompanied their erotic songs on the lute in the second half of the 10th century. As a result, much obscene sexual language came increasingly into use, such as would not have been tolerated in an earlier age. And still more glub on the fall of the Arab Empire. An increase in the influence of women in public life has often been associated with national decline. The later Romans complained that, although Rome ruled the world, women ruled Rome. In the 10th century, a similar tendency was observable in the Arab Empire, the women demanding admission to the professions hitherto monopolized by men. Many women practiced law, while others obtained posts as university professors. There was an agitation for the appointment of female judges. Soon after this period, government and public order collapsed, and foreign invaders overran the country. The resulting increase in confusion and violence made it unsafe for women to move unescorted in the streets, with the result that this feminist movement collapsed. Does this sound familiar to you? Any of it at all? I should mention, by the way, that John Bagot Glubb was a great authority on Arabic history and culture, and spent many years in the Middle East training Arab battalions. But why are any of these details about the 10th century Arab Empire at all relevant to us now, beyond the fact that the description seems eerily reminiscent of now? Because such details as these, and others on which I've been drawing, puts paid to the progressive notion that history only moves forward, or that the changes that they imagine are progress are in any way permanent. The people of each of these empires were full of hubris, thought themselves invincible, were unaware of the dangers that were around the corner for them until the very day that they happened, or in some cases, the day after they happened. Now, I could carry on listing different civilizational collapses like this for many hours, but I think the point is made. Now, there are many extremely learned men in history beyond Glubb who have noticed a pattern by which a steep decline in the moral order prefigures civilizational collapse, including Oswald Spengler, of course, whose theory of civilizations is a little bit too complex for us to get into here. Now, one of the most notable of these historians was Arnold Toynbee, whose monumental A Study of History notes several enduring features of cultures on the precipice of collapse, among them the loss of self-control, a general sense of drift and sense of sin, think of white guilt today, for example, and what he calls the sense of promiscuity, which include vulgarity and barbarism in manners, and vulgarity and barbarism in art. He describes this as an act of self-surrender to the melting pot as part of the process of social disintegration. The evidence for this pattern of rise and fall throughout history being tied to the moral and spiritual well-being of a people was once taken as basic common sense. Now things have regressed to the point where the hubris that afflicted the Persian, Greek, Roman and Arab empires before us blinds many people to the obvious truth of what is unfolding. I made this response series to clear the record as to what exactly I meant. I tried to answer all of the questions that Adam and Sitch had. Whether or not they watch this series, I suppose, will be a testament to their own intellectual curiosity and honesty. Let me know what you think in the comments. As I've mentioned, there's currently Ceylon, the academic agency, Autumn 25, gets you 25% off all courses, apart from Foundations of Research. And I'll see you next time. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.